I think when you're young, you have this image of what life will be and how it will pan out.
So I was born and grew up in Hong Kong. My parents are Dutch Swedish, so that makes me a third culture kid from a different culture, but growing up in another culture. And I didn't expect life to have as many curveballs, actually, as it would.
Welcome to Psychologically Speaking, a podcast all about human behaviour. I'm Leela, your psychologist, researcher and host. Last season was all about planning, direction and working towards something that felt fixed or purposeful. But this season is very different. This season is about what happens when life throws you curveballs and when the thing that you thought you were working towards suddenly shifts. Our theme? Expect the unexpected. I'm delighted to welcome Fenka to the chat. She describes herself as a third culture kid and founder. She worked internationally across Hong Kong, Belgium, Afghanistan, and the UK, navigating motherhood, relocations, and major life transitions along the way. She runs the Merry-Go-Round Club. It's a baby equipment rental club because she says that babies don't have to cost us the earth. Fenka, welcome to the Psychologically Speaking podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Leela. I'm very excited to be here.
It's great to have you. I love the idea that babies don't have to cost the earth. That's such a metaphorical and literal kind of tagline to have for a business. And I can't wait to hear how you came up with the idea and where you're at with it. What is your unexpected moment across your life or career that you want to talk about today?
I think when you're young, you have this image of what life will be and how it will pan out. You know, you know, as a child, especially as a girl, I think, well, I have children by this age and, you know, you have all sort of it in your head and when I'm grown up. And I didn't expect life to have as many curveballs, actually, as you said, as it would. Each one of them has made me who I am today and I'm grateful for a lot of them. Not all of them, but grateful for a lot of them. But I didn't expect life to be like that. I think I expected it to be a bit more plain sailing in that sort of Disney world that we get fed.
So we talked off camera a little bit about this idea of movement and adversity being two of those things that have just come up for you in your life. So we'll get into that. But first of all, tell me about the inspiration behind the Merry-Go-Round Club, how it all started and where are you with it at the moment?
Yeah, thank you. So Merry-Go-Round started. It had our first child in Hong Kong and we were living there at the time and it was a very transient environment. Lots of people were quite open to buying within the expat community, not the local community, but within the expat community, to buying secondhand and passing on. And so I would say about 90% of the things that we bought for our first was secondhand. And then we moved to the UK. So we moved back to the UK and had our second here quite soon after that. And I was quite good at finding secondhand, selling off things. And I just looked at the whole model and I thought, this isn't sustainable. It doesn't work. It's really expensive equipment that you're sort of sold that you have to have, but you use it for such a short period of time. And then it's up to you to sell on or pass on. Now, I was later in my friendship group to have children. So not only did I not get anything passed on to me when I got back to the UK, but I had no one else to pass it on to. And so, yeah, the model was broken in my view, and I felt there was a lot of waste. There was a lot of confusion around the things that we needed to do. Obviously, all the brands are very good at marketing what they need or what we need. Sorry. And so I sort of the inspiration came from there. I had been percolating the idea after my first, actually, and then had the second. Then there was COVID. So it sort of got delayed. Actually, no one would have rented during COVID. And then I met somebody at the school gate, actually, and she had a similar idea. And that sort of spurred me on to just to get going, really. So that's where we went.
What an amazing idea. And certainly, I mean, I've got one child, he's 10 now, but
when we had our first baby, I'll admit, you know, I look back at everything that we bought brand new. And there was a bit of, it was difficult because I think some of it was, I wanted to buy new things. This was a new thing coming into my life and I wanted to buy new things. But knowing what I know now on how little things are used and how temporarily, I don't think you know that when you're pregnant, or perhaps you don't realise it. So I think anything we can do to reduce our consumption and reuse is just amazing.
And the cost. I mean, it costs an absolute fortune to kit us out. And there's lots of people think, oh, I justify the cost. I'll buy it for the first and then I'll use it for the ones after.
Yeah.
But there's a period where, well, a fallow period, basically, where it's not being used because you don't know if you will have another, if you can have another. Mm. And it's just sitting there. It's not being used. It's not being utilized. And so I just... Yeah, I thought, right, well, rental is the way forward. And actually, we started with travel rentals because we knew that existing parents would get it. You know, multiples of carriers and bottles and all kinds of groups and things. They would get the fact that you don't need to buy another buggy to go on a holiday for 2 weeks. You can rent it. And then we started exploring it into the new mum space as well, or new parent space.
I do wonder then, because you have frequently moved and had movement across different countries and different organisations, do you think that's had an impact on the type of business that you've found?
Yes. And weirdly, I don't think about around the rental. I think it's more around the support. So I found that when I had my little one, it was quite a lonely period. Mm. You think, you know, after that afternoon nap, that sort of aching stretch until it's sort of bath and bedtime, but how am I going to fill that time? I mean, now obviously it'd be a luxury, but at the time I felt quite lonely. Now that mine are at school, there's a big community at school and I found an amazing group of women, but there's that period where you have little ones and you might go to a baby class and meet someone, but that's once a week for half an hour and then that's it. But around the rental piece and trying to remove the confusion around that, because I thought that was another big thing, is trying to provide a support. And so the way that we conduct our socials and things is very much, we're here for you, we understand, you know, it's all a phase, you're not doing anything wrong. And trying to provide that level of support to a mum at 3 a.m. in the morning when she's scrolling through Instagram when the baby is not going back to sleep after having had a feed. And the number of, I had actually, last night, I got a message at 3:15 saying, have you got this? When can you deliver it? I really desperately need it. So she's obviously been up all night with a little lunch. And think, so this is the cure. So it's actually around the support in the community, moving as much as I have. It's really important to create that. And I guess it's a skill that I've grown over time out of need and necessity.
Tell us a little bit about the unexpected movement in your life and also perhaps what was expected. So there must have been something about your childhood which meant that you moved more frequently. Yeah.
So I was born and grew up in Hong Kong. My parents are Dutch Swedish. They met there, were married there. So that makes me a third culture kid. The definition is basically one, you're from two different cultures or from a different culture, but growing up in another culture. And being in Hong Kong was a very expat community, but I wasn't an expat, but I wasn't local. So all friends and that I had at school, they would come in and then leave after 2-3 years because they were on expat contracts. But my father had his own business there. So he was there for 35 years, I think. And so we weren't expats, but we weren't local. So there was, from a very start, friends would come and go, that constant churn. You know, I talked to people and they're like, oh, yeah, no, we knew each other from nursery and we're still friends. I mean, I'm still friends with some of them, but that's quite rare compared to, the friends that I have here. So at the age of 16, we left Hong Kong. My father sold his business. The handover was happening. And their plan was to move back to Europe. So we moved to Belgium. But I only had 2 years left at school. So I did 2 years at school in Belgium. And then came here because all my education had been in English. So it was either studying here or America. Now, I'd never lived in either country and chose England as the closest. I was bereft leaving home. I did not want to leave home. And actually had a bigger culture shock coming from Belgium to England than I did from Hong Kong to Belgium.
Oh, in what way?
I think it comes down to expectation. So I'd grown up in Hong Kong, but spent my summers in Europe. So I'd spent summers in Holland. I'd spent summers in summer in Sweden. And I knew the culture that was around those European side of life. And I think the expectation was that with me speaking English and the language, that it would be similar to Europe. But England is not similar to Europe. I was very quickly put into a, because of the way I speak, everyone was in boarding school. I came from a decent family. And you say sort of pigeonholed me. And I'd never grown up in a class society environment before. And then socially, I found it very odd. In Europe, you start going out at about 10 o'clock at night. And that's when you start your evening. And so the first time I went to a pub and that bell went off, what's going on? And people had to explain to me, so it was last orders at the bar. So what do you mean last orders at the bar? I've just thought of it. And so, yeah, it was a real shift for me to come here. And so, yeah, there was that. Then I was here and lived in lots of different places, studied law, but didn't end up doing law, which was, again, quite a shift because everything I'd wanted to do, I wanted to be a lawyer. I was everything, you know, I was gearing towards that. I did a law degree. That was what I was going to do. Then I did the degree and decided, actually, I don't love this as much as I thought.
Whose expectation was that, Femke? Was that your expectation that you would do law? Was it family one?
No, it was mine. It was mine. My parents were quite, they weren't directional in that sense. My dad had done various things. He'd, in Holland, you have to be in the army. And then he'd gone to a bank and lived in Tanzania in the 60s and then Hong Kong and then Japan for a bit again in the 60s and then back and then had his own business. So, you know, it was very much my idea, but it's a very one direction idea. And when you cut that, I felt quite lost and I didn't have family in the UK to go back and stay with. I didn't have a really close, you know, family friend that I could stay with. I was on my own trying to figure it out. And that was, again, quite an adjustment. And I ended up falling into recruitment and didn't love it. I recruited legal secretaries for 3 months.
Okay.
As much as it went. And then I ended up in an outsourced recruitment company. And they featured a few times throughout my life, actually. Worked for them for 5 years. And again, still didn't love it, didn't really know where I was going. I ended up doing a people and communications diploma because I really wanted to get into the communication side of things. And managed that, worked at the DMGT, so Daily Mail General Trust, so the online part of the business. But then it was 2008 and no one needs the people with communications. And so I lost my job. And again, another hurdle. I just thought, what am I going to do now? And that was a really good wake-up call that very few of us have a second string to our bow. And I just thought, well, I've done all this, but now what can I do? And so at the time, I was a workout group on the common, a sort of outdoor workout. And the government were doing free NVQs for people to train to be a trainer. So I thought, right, that's my second string. So I trained to be a trainer. And that then became my morning job for 4 years before my day job.
So you were fitness training out on a common.
Yeah. In the rain, wind, snow, sleet, sun, all of it.
Joe Wixing before Joe was Joe Wixing.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was a female group and it was such a brilliant support and community that we're still in touch. So, yeah, I did that for 4 years and I was doing any kind of job. So I was selling cups in a pottery shop. I was handing out flyers, waitressed at the Freemasons. I did everything just to keep going because I had a mortgage at that point. Yep. And my ex at the time said, well, I always thought I'd have to support you, but I just hadn't anticipated doing so yet.
So I thought, right.
Okay.
I am not going to take anything from you. I am going to do this. And I did. And ended up, a friend of mine said, look, there's this guy up the road. He needs a bit of hand. If anything, it's some money for 3 months. So I thought, fine. Okay. So I met him and I ended up working with him for 4.5 years. And he had just signed a contract with Maersk, the Danish shipping line. Mm-hmm. And the Maersk run 40% of the US DOD freight. And so Captain Phillips, I don't know if you've seen that movie, that was one of our ships. And we ran the operations for them in Afghanistan because they were in Pakistan, but didn't want to be in Afghanistan. So, I mean, we're talking frozen chicken, plywood, toilet roll, but it's all essential. The soldiers all need that. And so I did that. I built and ran a container yard for 4.5 years in Kabul.
Go from being doing that personal training stuff, legal secretary recruitment, the stuff with the Freemasons, and then, you're an operational leader in international shipping. I mean, it's such a pivot.
Yeah, a massive, massive pivot. I mean, the Ross, sort of sofa pivot moment is a pivot. So I did that, and that contract came to a close, and I ended up being called by another Danish company. And that contract, by the way, I was based in London, going out to Kabul on visits, which was amazing, fascinating. But this other Danish company contacted me and said, work, call me.
Yeah.
So I did, called him. At the time, I was going through a divorce, and we had delayed our sale of the property because we were under that restrictive period where you have to pay back a lot of money, and we couldn't afford that. So he'd moved out, so that I was still at the time doing my PT on the common whilst running the container. That was giving me money to pay for my food, and how tight things were. I'd had to get a lodger in to help.
Yeah.
And then this guy called me and said, work, call me. So I did, and contacted him, and he said, I need a country manager on the ISAF base in Kandahar running NATO contracts. Will you do it? And the pay was great. It was tax-free. And I said, yes. So
how did you?
LinkedIn. I'd been on LinkedIn. I have been on LinkedIn since 2006. Mm. And I knew that with the Maersk contract ending, that I would need to do something else. And the other part of this guy's business was a family business with bakery equipment in Leeds and places like that. And, from bakery equipment to running a container yard in Kabul wasn't really floating the boat. So I started contacting people and saying, looking for something. And gosh, I think I'd messaged him 4 months before. And then he just sent me that out the blue. Work, call me. And I did, had a Skype interview. Accepted, didn't even meet them in person. Flew to Copenhagen for a month for orienteering, and then in September flew out to Kandahar and ran a team of 50 on an active army base in the war zone.
It's just so quite interesting, because I was sitting here going, I have no reference point for this life you've lived. I mean, I can't imagine what that is like. So tell us a little bit about what it's like being on an active army base, for an example.
Fascinating. I found it fascinating. Yeah. And I have, post the divorce, I knew I wanted to do something like this. And I knew that within the time frame of my life, this was my opportunity. So I just went for it. I live very much with, there's very little in life that's irreversible. And so I went for it. And so landed, and I was on rotation. So I was there for 9-10 weeks at a time, with a 2-3 week break in between. It's very odd. You are within the wire. So there's a wire perimeter around you. You are an active target, because it's a single runway, but it's the single busiest runway in the world. Mm. And it's all the supply chain that comes into the region goes through that base.
Oh, wow.
It has a massive drone center. And so in the time when drones were becoming quite sophisticated, we're talking little drones to enormous drones. And so we were a target, but also it was a bit
an sort of extracted reality because you were only within this perimeter. You saw the same people all the time. You know, you go to the cafeteria to eat. You drive down the same few roads. Everyone knows who you are. Everyone knows what your movements are, where you've been. As a woman, I was, I think, 2% of the population. As a blonde, there were two of us on base. At its height, there were 35,000 people on base. And so, yeah, it was fascinating. It was also a very selfish time for me. So
what
I would
work?
Well, all I did was eat, sleep, work, and work out.
Ooh.
And I made a sort of pledge vow to myself that I wasn't going to get involved with anyone. I was going to have a break. I was going to have some time off. And it was so peaceful because I didn't have to think about anyone else apart from me. And I was there, by the nature of it, I was in the office 6 days a week, but everyone knew who I was. And that's not just knew who I was. Everyone knew who everyone was.
Yeah.
And so you're on all the time. If you've got a rocket attack, you're in a bunker at 2 o'clock in the morning with your team, having to deal with them. You know, you share the ablutions, and I ran the mortuary and a construction business and the gym. You know, I'd have the mortuary manager having a shower next to me, asking me about shift rotations at 10 o'clock at night when I'm just trying to have a shower. But it was super selfish at that time, and actually a perfect timing for what I'd gone through and what I wanted to explore and do. I absolutely loved it. It was great.
The way that you use the word selfish, juxtapositioned with, I was also managing a mortuary and I was a target. It's such an interesting, interesting kind of concept because, you know, to the average person, that isn't a selfish thing. It was quite a selfless thing to put yourself in that space for other people. You know, you're providing such a life, literally a lifeline. And international conflict is something that, unfortunately, we're going to see more and more of, isn't it? So, wow. I mean, I'm just blown away by that. I just think it's such an amazing kind of trajectory that you've had. And this movement then that we're talking about, this unexpected the movement, what do you think it has given you? What gifts has that given you?
It's given me a lot of confidence in that it's allowed me to, I've put myself into situations that are not the norm. And with that sort of mantra that I have, very little in life is irreversible. I think it shows me time and time again that at tricky times, I can do it. Take that stance. I can do a job. I can do a task. I can do what needs to be done. And that confidence, you know, and it also gives me a little boost. It's not often that I sit back and get the chance to talk about this. So thank you. But it's a reminder that I had, you know, I was alive before dropping children off at the school and taking them to football training. There's extra there. And I think it's given me a confidence and strength that I can do things if needed.
It is. I hear that in your voice. It's such a lovely gift to have been given. I'm sure there's been challenges and we'll get to that. But there's something psychologically that is just sitting with me at the moment, which is, when you study psychology, one of the first things we learn is about child development. And there's a psychologist called Piaget, and his work, you know, it might not always hold true, but he was the person who came up with this idea that we have schemas in our head of how the world is supposed to be. When you have a toddler, sometimes we download those apps that say your toddler is now going through this phase. And now, you know, there's a reprogramming of the brain and a new schema. And you know, that it's that thing where a child's world suddenly becomes bigger than them, or we shift from either being the centre of our own universe to being the centre of somebody else's space, etc. And it's just this interesting thing that I wonder then how these shifting schemas of culture and community and being an outsider in Hong Kong sometimes and feeling that you weren't quite of one culture or the other, finding community, creating community as a PT, and then going and sitting and putting yourself into a very rigid community, you know, being on an army base, that is a rigid community. So it's just very interesting to me as a psychologist that this kind of schematic of world is constantly shifting and changing. And you're saying, yeah, it brings resilience, it brings confidence. What about the downside? I mean, you say that there's very little that's irreversible. So it would suggest to me that perhaps you're less full of regret, but is there anything that you wish hadn't happened in the way that it's happened, or something that's made you different that you're regretful about?
I don't think I hold too much regret. I think when I was younger, I suppose, regret is something that comes with the benefit of hindsight. Mm. So I think at the time that every choice I've made, I made that choice at that time because I felt it was the right choice.
Mm.
And I think regret is something that comes with hindsight. You think, oh, I shouldn't have done this, or I should have done that a little bit differently. And it then becomes a learning point.
Mm.
But I don't sit and think of huge regret and reflect on it that way, because I do think at the time it was the right thing for me. And that's why I made those decisions and choices.
I think it's amazing. I've loved hearing about that kind of trajectory. So then, take us from the point at which, obviously, you were abroad, you were on an active site, and then there's a point in time when you're back in the UK and that's the launch of your business. So what's happening in between there?
So I went to Kandahar in 2013, mm-hmm. and at the end of 2014, the troop drawdown happened. So I knew that the NATO contracts were coming to a close. Mm. Within that time, I had been on shore leave and came back here. And post my divorce, a friend of mine said, why don't you download Tinder? And I said, don't be ridiculous. It's a cheap, tawdry pickup app. But then I got bored and downloaded Tinder and met this chap who was too busy dating to see me. But before I went back out, and then, because obviously it wasn't from my Afghan radius, but went back out, and we chatted on WhatsApp for 10 weeks. And then I met him, and he then got posted to Hong Kong.
Oh.
And he called me after 2 weeks of knowing him in person and said, will you join me in Hong Kong? Now, going back to there's very little in life that's irreversible,
yeah.
I knew at the end of 14 that I would need to look for a job. And I would either go back to London and back to my place, or I could go back to Hong Kong and I could work there. I had friends there. I knew Hong Kong, and give it a go with this job. So I said yes. So I went back to Hong Kong and moved there at the end of very end of 14. And we ended up getting engaged, married, and had our first baby there. And that it was his job that brought us back from Hong Kong to London. And we didn't feel that we had really done all of the time we wanted to in Hong Kong. We were sort of plucked from Hong Kong too early through the job. He didn't feel he could say no to the move back to London. Yeah. So we came back to London. And again, that was a real heartache for me, was leaving Hong Kong.
How old was your child at the time?
5 months.
Wow. And that period of time, I mean, your business is very much about supporting mothers during those early things. But that first 5 months, your support network is everything at that 5 months. So,
yeah. So came back here, didn't want to be here at all, and was quite upset. And the plan always was to go back to Hong Kong. I was due to go back to work and ended up in a court case with them, so I didn't go back to work, and then also found out I was pregnant again, so then had our second, and 2020 was going to be our year. So we resigned in January. We gave notice on our place. We had all our things packed for long-term storage to be shipped to Hong Kong. The plan was 6 months in France, and then October 2020 we were going to go back to
course in 2020. Yeah. We had this international unexpected event.
We had no job, no house, no things, a car, a trailer, two children, and a dog. And our youngest wasn't even one.
Wow.
So, and the dog had come with us from Hong Kong, by the way, to London.
What were you thinking at that point? What was going through your head at that point?
I personally, it was tricky because our relationship wasn't in place. But as a whole, I thought France is not that far. It's not that bad. Yeah. And like all of us, I didn't think COVID would drag on as long as it did. And so I was really doubting about going to France because of the state of our relationship, but went with it. And we ended up being stuck here, stayed in a friend's place for 2 months. And then when they opened the border to France, we drove and made it to France. But then COVID kept rumbling on and we kept extending. His reasoning was, we haven't got a job to go to. We haven't got to be there. Here in France, we've got lots of space. You know, people wanted to rent places because no one was renting anything. And so we had a place in Provence. We moved all over France, by the way. We'd stayed in one place for 10 months. And that had an olive orchard in the garden. And, you know, it was in the middle of, we just hiked everywhere. And it was a very fit COVID for us. That Christmas 2020, Hong Kong put quarantine in place. And that really was the point where we were not going back to Hong Kong. And I wanted to go back to Hong Kong, but I knew that I couldn't go back to Hong Kong in the familial setup that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst I've had a lot of change and I don't like change, my partner didn't deal with change very well. And so I thought, right, I cannot go to Hong Kong. Plus, I can't do 3 weeks in a hotel room with the four of us where you can't even open a window because not all four of us would leave. It was not a good spot to be in. So after staying in France, and things started opening up in France a bit more, and we'd gone to a playground. And that for me was a real turning point because my two littles had had each other, thankfully. But a playgroup had gone to the playground and there were little children. Uh-huh. And my two just stopped and stared. Yeah. Like, there's other little people in this one. Now, my eldest has been to nursery and done all the groups and all of that. So he had still memories of that. But my youngest had no concept of that. And I thought, right, we need to get back to civilization. My tenants gave notice. And with that, I took back the council tax. And with that, I applied to the schools locally. And we got a spot. So that dragged us back to London. And I was very grateful to come back to London at that point. And so we got back in 21 and have been here since. I applied for jobs and kept getting down to the last two. And it never quite working. And I'd had this idea percolating. And then I met this mum who had a similar idea. And just that sort of was the catalyst. And we went for it.
Before we get back to the conversation, a quick note. If you enjoy these kinds of psychological reflections about work and identity, you might like my reflection room. This is the group coaching space. The doors are open right now, and over the next few months, we'll be running 3 live workshops on dealing with rejection, imposter phenomenon, and managing multiple identities at work. If that sounds useful, you can find all of the details at leelaange.co.uk/reflection room. Now back to the episode.
And what stands out for me there is just the contrast then of the two arrivals into the UK. That first when three actually. So you've left Hong Kong and you've come to the UK previously as a younger person, and it's been that massive culture shock. But then, interestingly, the second time that you come back to the UK, it feels warmer. It feels like that's familiarity to you. That's, you came back to something that you knew what to expect. And that's interesting, isn't it? That change is destructive, but it's either familiar or unfamiliar.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that framework of knowledge and simple things like, you know, where to go for a dentist appointment.
Yeah.
You know, where the doctor is for your child. Knowing where that is, coming back into that was a comfort and a thought and worry less. There's so much in terms of planning and logistics. That's a good thing. I'm basically a project manager at heart, that all of that I can do. But it does, having
own awareness and knowledge of that gives a great comfort to come back to.
So I'm interested to explore in this season, obviously, expect the unexpected. But how has that changed your outlook on life as we scan forward in the horizon? Are you a planner or do you live year by year? I'm kind of interested where your focus is.
I am a planner. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very, in my, doesn't feel like it at the moment just because things are so busy, but in my life, I'm very organized. So I do all the admin, for example, in the house, all the paperwork, all the bills, all the like insurances and all of that. That's all my sort of pot. And so I do plan that and I do have that in mind moving forward, you know, already thinking, okay, the boys are at this age. Do they need a tutor at some point? What are the next stages for schools? Where do we need to get to for all of this to happen? And where, you know, how does that pan out? Keep thinking about scenarios, how to work around them and have a little bit of a structure so that things don't come at me from left field. And it's like the branches come out of nowhere. Well, what am I going to do? So I am very much of a planner. Mm. When things get chucked in there, it does and can send me for a bit of a tiz. Mm. And I get a bit of sort of nervous angst to deal with it. But then once I've worked it through, and it takes me a little while to process, but when I have worked it through, then I feel comfortable with that level of sort of requirement again and then move forward with it. So
what you're describing now, I love this, is this kind of like this wave that as change comes up, it is a wave. You still feel all of the expected human emotions when unexpected changes happen. But there's that settling into period where you take that breath and you think it through and you work through it that's sustaining you. And that's resilience, isn't it? That's what we're describing as a real benefit of all of this movement and unexpectedness in your life is it's created a framework of resilience for you.
Yeah. I've not looked at it like that, but yes. Yeah, it does, actually. Thank you. Thank you for helping me.
Hearing you talk about, well, that's happened before and nothing is undoable. Just the language you use is just very interesting. And it's very curious to me that there's this kind of, well, I'll just move on with that and I can move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, you know, being in relationships and, you know, sort of serious relationships and then ending as well and knowing that there's a great unknown out there. I don't know what that's going to look like and what that's going to happen. But if I look back, I know that if it happens, then I will sell pots in a pottery shop or I will do PT on a common or, you know, I can do these things and I will do these things and I will keep going and I will survive as such and get to the point where it will hit a new point where I can thrive rather than just survive.
So let me ask a question then, because obviously the roles that you've had and certainly some of the international roles, you've been very much what you were describing even at 10 p.m. at night, stood in the showers next to somebody and providing support and advice. You are the keeper, the looker after, the organiser, and you describe that in your current admin in the home, that type of thing. Who looks after Femke?
Yeah, not so much me. What do I do? I love reading. Exercise is a real mainstay for me. If I haven't had the exercise and it becomes that split, so I haven't got the time to exercise, but I know if I don't exercise, then, and so exercise is a big one for me. Friends as well. I have a good, solid group of friends who are there through everything with me. I'm a great communicator. I often over-communicate and probably bore lots of people, but I share a lot. I share a lot. And, you have friends that don't share very much and they keep it themselves to themselves. But I do share a lot about what's going on and what's happening. Mm. And I find that's quite important for me. So I think the friends would be there for me and the exercise would be there for me.
And you've developed a community as well. So you've kind of got this community of care that you're doing through the Merry-Go-Round Club. It's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, we can, so there's the term, so we used to talk about the world being quite VUCA, so volatile, and the new word is banny, so brittle, anxious, or whatever. But it strikes me that when we use acronyms for things rather than talking them through,
we're not dealing with the emotion. And I mentioned that on a podcast episode in my previous season where I was talking about sustainability. And there's something really interesting as you're speaking, which is just how you've sustained. And it's not an endure. And that feels different again, you know, enduring things and sustaining things are two very different ways of living. Sustaining feels like you're moving through it with choice. Enduring feels that things are happening to you. And I thought I might leave you with that reflection that what I'm hearing you describe is a sustainability, really, which is at the heart of your business.
Yeah, it does. It comes full circle, that sustainability of support, community, and whilst we're providing the kit, which is the cornerstone of it, it's that's the physical support of a parent going and caregivers going through a really amazing but tiring and tricky phase of life. It's also providing the emotional support that comes with that as well, and hoping that continues really.
So your business then, how do people find out about it, and who is it actually for, and where is it? Is it geographically across the UK, or is it in certain towns?
Yeah, so Merry-Go-Round is at Merry-Go-Round Club. That's how you can find that. That's also our socials, Merry-Go-Round Club, all in one. We are a baby equipment rental service. So we provide kit for children 0 to up to 4, really. Mm-hmm. And we have travel rentals, which are 2-week rentals. So you can rent a travel buggy or a travel cot or a carrier or a backpack carrier or things like that you need for a short period. Otherwise, we do monthly rentals and they're flexible. So you can rent for 6 months and decide, actually, you know what, this breast pump isn't working for me. I want to turn it back and, you know, we'll take it back. Or you rent it for 2 and think, this is brilliant, I want it for another 6, and that's fine too. We do carrier bundles. So one size does not fit all. And we have 3 carriers you can rent for a month and either decide to keep renting that or make an informed purchase decision. And we have newborn bundles. So we rent 7 key things that you need for the first 6 months. Oh, we deliver all in one go. And then after 6 months, your little one's grown out of it and we take all of you again. And we also provide, we're also a maternity paternity benefit provider for the likes of WPP, HSBC, a household name I'm not allowed to mention, but we cover 100,000 employees through those 3 companies.
Wow.
And we deliver all over the UK. So we are at the behest of DPD. But if it's local to me, then you get me showing up on your doorstep because I still like to see the customers and get some feedback from them.
I love that.
And create a rapport and going back to that support. And, you know, I've opened the door to a mum who's, you know, leaking. I've opened the door to a mum who just crumbled in my arms and burst into tears and sort of helped scoop her up and things like that. I was just glad, and I think the reason the business was there was to help people like that. And you know, if I could help provide her some support and in that time and that moment, and then that really makes what we're doing extra worthwhile. And so that's who we are and what we do. And we are 2 this month.
Congratulations and happy birthday.
And we are about to start raising so that we can expand what we're doing just to greater volumes for more people. So we're raising, so you'll hear more about that on socials and things, but that's who we are and where we are.
Wow, such amazing. I've got a very soft spot for maternal mental health. I sit on an advisory group for a CIC in Derbyshire. And that's as a result of some work I did setting up a psychologically informed maternal mental health service during COVID. Mm. Maternal and paternal mental health is such an important thing. And it is about community and it is, you know, about being connected. I'm really, really intrigued by everything that you're doing. But the backstory, wow.
Yeah.
I think there's a memoir in there somewhere.
You're not the first to say that. Which is very flattering. I mean, it's interesting. At some point, hopefully my children will find it interesting too when they realise.
Yeah, I mean, I've loved the majority of it and the experiences that it's given me and, you know, some of the things I can share and, yeah. But I will say, sorry, just going back to the merry-go-round, we also have a section of it that I'm trying to develop, which is called the Kind Initiative. And so the word kind in Dutch is kind, and that means child. So it's like the Kind Child Initiative.
Yes.
And I'm trying to get the system to do a pay it forward thing. So when people rent, they can pay it forward and that money will go into a pot and that will provide kit for parents in need. Because I just really think that every child deserves a good start. And we've done something locally here through the church, actually, because they couldn't afford it but desperately needed something. Mm. And so that's something I am trying to grow and develop as well alongside all the commercial stuff.
Wow. I love that. I love that idea. It's just so much needed as well. And there's so many people out there who find it such a discombobulating time. I count myself in that. Femke, it's been an absolute delight to have you on. I have loved hearing about your story, your unexpected moments and all of this movement and, you know, adversity as well. I think there's some real life lessons in there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's working for me so far.
That's all for today. You've been listening to Psychologically Speaking with me, Leela Ainge.